Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. University presidents are under a lot of pressure. The Trump administration is dictating policy and yanking federal funds. Ohio lawmakers have passed a massive and controversial overhaul for higher education. As the overhaul, known as Senate Bill 1, moved through the Ohio House and Senate, university presidents from across the state, for the most part, stayed silent. As that bill is just a few steps away from becoming law, we're going to talk about the changes with our guest this hour, Ohio State University President Walter Ted Carter, Jr. Welcome back to All Sides, President Carter.
Good to see you, Amy.
So you've been on the job for not quite a year and a half. It's been an eventful time. There have been many highs. The university has record research funding, more than Harvard. Listeners perhaps know of some of the athletics successes that have been going on, and we will get to all that. But I want to start with the higher education bill known as Senate Bill 1. The Ohio Senate is expected to concur on some minor changes that the House made, and the bill will then head to Governor DeWine's desk, where he is likely to sign it. He has signaled that he will sign it. So are you supportive of this bill? Do you hope that Governor DeWine does sign it?
Well, quite frankly, it doesn't matter whether I want him to sign it or not. He's telegraphed that he is going to. And I don't want to push back too hard on your opening comment there, but you're correct in that the Inter-University Council, the IUC, the group of 14 public university presidents and chancellors, did not take an official position on SB1. Nor did our Board of Trustees, or nor did we as the Ohio State University. However, we've been working since SB 83 was formed, as SB 1 came into the focus. We have been working actively behind the scenes to try to put a lot of corrections into that. And we made a tremendous amount of input on SB 1, mostly to protect academic freedom, freedom of speech, our curricula, to support our faculty, staff, and students, to look at the future of who we are as an institution. We did not get everything that we asked for in our changes. We did get some, and I wish we had gotten more. But the reality is this is going to be a bill that's going to pass. We're still analyzing some of the details of the language that's in there, and we'll obviously respect the law. But as I look at it today, and there are some concerns in there over, what we do in the classroom, we're going to be okay. We're going to be fine. And we're going to be sitting down with our faculty and staff and students so they understand, what SB1 means, what the impact is. There are some administrative processes in there that we have to review. All of the public institutions are going through a cost analysis of what that is. So there will be some additional administrative burden. We know that. We've got to put syllabi on a forward-facing internet. That's going to be about a year to get through that process. A lot of our courseware is already out there. Mm-hmm. Tenure review, we already have that. And I've made a lot of those points along the way. A lot of things that were in this, we already do. So yes, it is a bit of a challenging time. People are worried about the predictability of what we're going to do. But we're going to persevere through this.
Do you think you could have gotten more changes to Senate Bill 1 if you would have stood up publicly, if you would have went down to a committee hearing and spoken in public about it?
I don't think the change would have been there. They knew where their constituents were in terms of the voting on it, and we were aware of that, too. I spent a lot of time inside the State House and talked to key leaders in both the House and the Senate. So they were very, very much understanding of where we were. One of the biggest things that we opposed and we didn't win was having our student board of trustees have a vote. I'm very proud of our student board of trustees, and I still don't quite understand why they thought that that was something that shouldn't be in there, other than the fact that our other 13 publics don't have their student representatives vote. But it isn't that they're not allowed to. It's that our board of trustees voted within the law, the previous law, that they could. And I'm disappointed that we don't have that in there. Now, our student board of trustees will still have influence because their voices will matter. And by the way, that's what I dealt with when I was at the University of Nebraska. Our board of regents there, publicly elected, had student representatives from each campus, and their votes didn't tally either. Mm.
So one part of Senate Bill 1 involves diversity, equity, and inclusion. You've been criticized for preemptively ending DEI programs at Ohio State. You got rid of two DEI departments. You eliminated 16 positions. And you moved quickly. This was as soon as President Trump signed an executive order. The Senate Bill 1 was still being debated. Why did you decide to take such swift action instead of waiting for Senate Bill 1 to pass?
Yeah, it's great to be able to talk about this because the first thing that you should know is, unlike some of my other colleagues across the nation and even here in the state, we were open, transparent, sincere, and honest about what we were doing. I made the statement in front of the entire university senate, and you know, we didn't just send out an email and say we were going to do this. We did this not in a vacuum. It was coordinated across the entire campus, even though some people still felt some sense of surprise. We knew that Senate Bill 1 was going to pass, but this wasn't a preemptive action on that. This was trying to telegraph with the intent of what was coming out of the federal government to protect what was in our best interest, which is, as you're seeing at many other campuses, losing federal grants, big time money for not complying with, you know, what this long range view is on DEI. And let's just unpack that for a second. Whether we like it or not, with newly elected leaders at the federal and the state level, DEI has become a lightning rod for some perceived, and I'll use that word perceived, giveaway to marginalized groups. Now, I don't agree with that. I have dealt with diversity, equity, inclusion programs. This is my 12th year leading higher education. I did it for 6 years in uniform at the Naval War College, the Naval Academy, 4 years in Nebraska, now a year plus here. So I know the strength of those programs. I know what they can do. When I came here to Ohio State, there were some things that we may have or may not have been doing that needed to be corrected, meaning that I wanted to make sure that everything we were doing was based on meritocracy. We were entering into a period where the Supreme Court said, hey, affirmative action for admissions is no longer allowed. So that was, you know, one of those first things that said, hey, you don't give away something just because you're a person of color. And we persevered through that. In fact, our numbers for African-American students in this last year in a post-affirmative action, non-affirmative action, are the best we've ever seen. Mm. So we've learned how to navigate in this period. Our number of African-American students on campus is 5,450. That's the highest number we've ever had. Hispanic students, 3,900, highest number we've ever seen. And when people say, how did you do that? I would say, well, we're just representative of the demographics of Ohio, where 73% of our students out of 67,000 are Ohioans. Mm-hmm. We're going to have the same approach in the DEI space. So we took a scalpel to go after one administrative program. That was the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, which does date back to 1970. I know the history of it, and I know how it has also evolved and been reimagined over the years. And I would tell you that although it won't have those same acronym letters and associated with what we will do next, we will be doing the same thing. The Center for Belonging and Social Change is a student support organization. So what we haven't talked about publicly that much is, what do we look like in this next phase? And although we've had programs that were there to support that, the goodness of those programs, which has been very good, will continue, but in a broader sense. So where we had support for some of these marginalized groups, we're still going to support all students, all faculty, and all staff. We will continue to do those things. All of the scholarships that were associated historically with students of color, none of those have been taken away. We will continue with scholarships, but again, open those up to all students. So the Morrill Scholars, the Young Scholars, all those programs will continue, which is very different than our competitor, that school up north, who just announced this weekend that they were discontinuing a certain scholarship program. So we have tried to do the right things for the right reason. We did do this work and sunsetting, if you will, the Office of Diversity and Inclusion ahead of Senate Bill 1. And that's allowing us to spend a little bit more time as we're now going through some listening sessions with our students, with our faculty and our staff. Even our university senate is now going to be involved in what right looks like going forward. And we have a lot of good ideas. We're not ready to say what all that looks like just yet, but we're going to continue to support our students. you know, who we welcome and how we treat everybody with dignity and respect and how we get them to be successful, that is a bedrock principle on which this university has always been. I mean, you go back to 1870, right, when we were founded, and the first class that we had here of 24 students in 1873 had women in the class. I mean, how progressive was that? And that's something that we should be proud of. We haven't always gotten it right at this institution and how we've treated various diverse groups. But I do appreciate where we are now. I know I also appreciate how concerned people are. And I understand there's been some anger out there. Some of it's been directed at me. I can handle that. But what they may not know is we're going to apply some common sense here and make sure that we're going to take care of our students, faculty, and staff, as we always have.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and this is All Sides with Amy Jurevich. We're talking with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. We're talking about the higher education bill, known as Senate Bill 1. And students and faculty were at the forefront of all the protesting over the elimination of the DEI programs and for the higher ed bill. It's one of the most contentious pieces of legislation in recent memory, with more than 1,500 people on the record opposing it, which is a lot for a piece of legislation. Here's a member of the Ohio State faculty, history professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries, during a student protest at the Oval. He's recounting for the students something he said during this interview program.
And I was asked my thoughts on our dear president, President Carter. And I said, the verdict is still out. I said, I'm not sure if he's incompetent. I'm not sure if he's a coward. I'm not sure if he's complicit. But I think we know now it's all three.
Now, those are strong words. How do you respond to that criticism? Because I think what Professor Jeffries is getting at is he wanted to see you in public down at the State House saying no to parts of this bill.
Well, first of all, I don't know Professor Jeffries. He's never met me. You know, I understand people are angry and they have opinions. You know, I wore the uniform for 38 years to support the First Amendment and the Constitution of the United States. So I stand behind anybody that wants to have an opinion and express it, and that's their right. But I'm looking out for what is in the benefit for this university long range, long term, and I'll continue to do that, and I'll stand behind what we're doing. This university is going to prosper going forward. Yes, there's some challenges here, and you know, I didn't draft SB1. I didn't create the executive orders that are coming out of the White House. So, you know, we're trying to react to those things and make sure that we're looking out for everybody's best interests. And by the way, I'll let the deeds that I have performed in my life stand on anything that opposes some of those words that he said.
Now, one thing that is in Senate Bill 1 is the idea that they're guarding against liberal indoctrination. They're saying that they want more conservative viewpoints in universities. Do you think that universities such as Ohio State are too liberal?
You know, there's this idea nationwide, and this is, you know, the challenge of higher ed, and President Ron Daniels from Johns Hopkins and I talked about this yesterday in a fireside chat. We have to understand what some of the perceptions of higher ed are, whether they're real or not. And we have to be willing to make some adjustments because that is a perception of a lot of people. Personally, as I have been in higher ed for the years that I have been, now I said 12th year as an administrator, I have not felt that our faculty indoctrinate students or try to bring them into some sort of liberal side. You know, there are people out there that have statistics on, you know, Republican versus Democrat versus, you know, all our professors. So all that data is out there. What I think is the intent inside of SB1 is, you know, we should still be able to have a dialogue on all of these topics in the classroom. That's why you go to university. You want to be exposed to a bunch of different ideas. The maturation process of our students and that critical 18 to 25 year old range, that's what they're expecting. It's the experiential that makes a difference for them to be in that classroom and to hear other points of view. And what I think is the drive that's coming out of SB1 is that faculty members can't tell students what to think. We're trying to teach students how to think. And I believe we've been doing that all along. I don't feel like I have to go to the State House and say, we're not doing that and try to, you know, defend that because I don't see that happening on our campuses to begin with. And our students want to have exposure to those different ideas. And I believe we'll still have those conversations in the classroom. That's what academic freedom is. When you can have a conversation about a topic that's germane to the topic that you're teaching and listen to those different viewpoints. You know, we created a new module on our campus just this past year, kind of associated with how can you have a discussion with somebody when you don't agree with them? And it's called Listen, Learn, Discuss. And it's been widely popular by our students to take this. And we're going to make some changes to it so we can continue to have that kind of dialogue. I think it's really important. It's part of what Education for Citizenship really is. And it's our motto from 1938. And it's the centerpiece of our 10-year strategy.
We've had faculty on the program talking about Senate Bill 1. And one thing that they are worried about is the enforcement mechanism is that, you know, students can report, you know, like my opinion wasn't listened to in the class or something like that. And they worry about students reporting if they stand up and their opinion is the earth is flat and the professor needs to move on with the material and just say, no, you're wrong.
Right.
Right. Then they're going to get cited through this bill and they can be. Do you have worries for your faculty about that, about too aggressive attacks from students?
Obviously, you can take these things to an extreme and come up with scenarios where it becomes a little bit troubling or worrisome. Remember, there'll be a due process to this. We will create it at Ohio State. It will be managed internally through our faculty, through our shared governance, and up to the office of the president. I mean, so, you know, we're not bringing in the thought police here to say what you can or cannot say.
Your office will have a say before anyone loses their job over this.
Of course. And the authority will still come up to the president, not to the legislature.
Another part of the bill that was controversial, it got eliminated in the first version of the bill a year ago, is the ban on faculty strikes. Faculty strikes are uncommon in higher education. There was one at Wright State several years ago. About 5 years ago, there was one at Youngstown State. But the bill sponsor, Republican Jerry Serino, has framed this provision as a matter of fairness. Students pay tuition. They expect to be taught. What's your response to that? I would think as a university president, you don't want a strike, right? But should they be allowed to or have that option?
Well, it's not something we have to deal with right now at Ohio State because we're not unionized with our faculty. So they're not part of that element in it. I understand the concern, and you're right. The labor piece of this, I think, is what really hung up 83 last year. Mm-hmm. I think there could be some challenges to that. As you said, strikes are very rare. I know faculty don't want to strike because they know that over some longer period of time, it can hurt their students. And if you look at the history, as you just cited, they've been very, very rare and short-lived here, and they're usually centered around pay. So, again, for a place like Ohio State, we're always looking at a review of compensation for our faculty and staff, and we're going to continue to do that. And, again, it's all about fairness.
Your organization of all the university presidents who are working behind the scenes, was that one of the provisions? Were you trying to get it taken out again and it didn't? Or what was something that you tried to get taken out?
I personally did not get involved in that only because we don't have that unionization within our faculty. So I did not engage in that personally.
Okay. What is something that you wanted taken out of the bill? You mentioned that you fought behind the scenes to get things taken out and they took some things out, but not everything. What's something you wanted out of the bill?
Well, I didn't feel like the General Assembly should get directly involved in curriculum development. I argued that we could achieve what they were looking for on our own. We have a number of those courses already. We're standing up the Salmon P. Chase Center for Civics. So I argued that that was an unnecessary part of the bill. I didn't win that argument. So we will take a look at our curriculum and work on that courseware. But what's maybe more important is what's not in that bill. There's nothing in there that tells us what we can't teach. So as you know, we have a wide array of over 200 academic disciplines, you know, thousands of courses that we teach, and we're going to continue to teach those courses. You know, I also asked for some more clarity on the definition of diversity, equity, inclusion. There wasn't a lot of detail in that language, although they did put in stipulations to understand how we can take care of disabled students. And as a lot of your listeners know, diversity, equity, and inclusion is not just about the color of people's skin. It's about all these different ranges of veterans, single parents, first-generation students, disabled students. We're going to continue to support all those students, as I said earlier, and the rest of all of our students. So we wanted some, you know, a little bit of clarity there. And those are some of the big ones there. You know, we put in the right authorities for where the responsibility and the accountability to these pieces are between the board of trustees or regents and our own office of the president. So again, as we talked about who's going to make those decisions to follow the law, that will be our responsibility in the front administration.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Ohio State President Carter about the Trump administration's investigations into Ohio State and other universities. And we're also going to talk about the Civic Center that he just mentioned and an event that they held there yesterday. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The Trump administration has moved quickly to put colleges and universities on notice that it will not be business as usual, especially if they want to keep receiving federal funds. Earlier this month, Ohio State learned it is the subject of two investigations by the Trump administration, along with other universities. Still with us is Ohio State University President Ted Carter Jr. Thanks again for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
So one of the investigations includes Ohio State and 45 other universities and is looking at discrimination as related to the PhD project. This PhD project encourages minorities to pursue doctorate degrees. Do you feel like the race component in this lawsuit is true?
So we had to go find out what our actual involvement with that is. And although I don't want to talk too much about this because this is still, you know, an investigation, we were involved with it at some point. We have not really done a lot there. And other than saying, you know, we're still waiting to talk to the Office of Civil Rights about our actual involvement, I'll just say that we're not involved in Project PhD today. So we'll learn more. As you probably know, through these executive orders, many of the offices of civil rights have been shut down, to include the Cleveland office, which is who we had been working with. So we're still waiting to make our connections with those the people that are left to do that work to find out what it is that they're looking for.
Yeah. How are you sued by a department that doesn't exist anymore?
Well, there are people working it in the Washington, D.C. office. I think there's still some people working out of maybe a Denver office. So we're just starting to get into that dialogue.
Okay. The other investigation is a warning to Ohio State and other universities to protect Jewish students, citing that federal funding for the university is dependent upon following all anti-discrimination laws. So what is Ohio State's response to that?
Well, I'll stand on our actions. We'll hold people accountable for any type of anti-Semitic behavior. We respect freedom of speech, and there's been protests dating back to October 7th of last, 2023, when the horrible event happened with Hamas and Jewish students. We have, navigated the space, I think, differently than many other universities. We basically said, hey, these are our campus rules, and we followed them. Unfortunately, some really tested that on April 25th of last year, where we sadly did have to go through a few arrests. And we haven't had any problems since. I mean, this was all about trying to create encampments and then dig in so that people would somehow feel like they could have their demands met. And we didn't allow that. There's a way to have a protest and be able to speak to this thing. But I feel strongly that we have protected our Jewish students. I know when I speak to Jewish community leaders throughout Columbus and the state, they feel the same way. So we're ready to have that dialogue with OCR, whatever it is that they think. I think some of those, and I will just say this, we had been in dialogue with OCR, with the Biden administration people, and I'm not sure that's still not a carryover from where that was, because we
OCR,
did not, so, Office of Civil Rights.
Okay, got it.
Yes. We had been in that dialogue with them previously, and it was unfinished in terms of its findings. So that may be a follow-on. We're still waiting to hear what those details are.
When it comes to the pro-Palestinian protests, I mean, how does peacefully protesting a war classify as anti-Semitism? Do you see those two?
Well, we've been in a unique period of time in our country's history. You go back and look at the, you know, the protest era of the Vietnam War, and most of those protests were against a larger entity like the government. What we have seen differently in this case was on many campuses across the country, we had pro-Palestinian groups protesting against students on their own campus. Mm. And that's where that's been troubling here. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around why students would think that other students would be involved in, you know, some of these actions that are being done by leaders at the state level. That's what's a little bit different here. And you saw on some campuses across the country where encampments happened, they couldn't be protected. There was violence that broke out. Some Jewish students weren't even allowed to get to class. You know, what we have taken approach is that our mission is to allow everybody to have access to class, access to their commencements, access to clinical care. That's why we didn't allow encampments. That's why our space rules, our campus rules are so strong. It's a public place for everybody.
There's news coming out of Columbia University, which is related here, that they're hoping to get $400 million in federal funding restored. So they're working with the administration. Do you worry about the administration cutting off funding? What's happening with Columbia? I mean, could that happen here?
I don't think so, just because of the actions that we've taken in the past. And I feel like we can stand behind the things that we've done, the things that we've said. We've been honest, we've been truthful, we've been predictable about our actions and protecting all of our students. And, you know, there's no place for anti-Semitism here at Ohio State or any university. So I feel comfortable that we will not see that type of action taken against Ohio State.
And, you know, on earlier this week, there was a hearing on the case of a graduate student, a pro-Palestinian protester from Columbia. Do students at Ohio State, do they need to worry at all whether they're protesting anything? Do they need to worry about their student visas being revoked?
Well, they shouldn't, again, as long as they're following the law. And obviously, we're watching what's happening at other campuses. I have not seen any indication that our students are afraid to speak their voice. I mean, we certainly saw some of that yesterday. So I haven't seen any indication that people are worried about that.
Well, let's talk about yesterday. So a bill that requires civics literacy classes to learn about how you can be an involved and informed citizen. A part of that was to create the Samlin P. Chase Center for Civics, Culture, and Society. Sorry, that has a lot of C's in it.
I was
struggling with how to say it. Can we call it the Chase Center?
We'll just call it the Chase Center.
The Chase Center. And so you had an event yesterday with the president of Johns Hopkins University, Ronald Daniels, and you both spoke about the importance of civics education and the role higher education must play in preparing students to be informed citizens. So how universities need to better communicate what they do. Here's Johns Hopkins President Ronald Daniels speaking about that challenge.
At least one public official has called universities the enemy. And so, you know, it's in that setting, we, I think, have to really hear, as hard as it is in this moment, the critique against us, to listen carefully and evaluate critically whether there's some things that we need to do better in order to ensure that we continue to enjoy the support and confidence of our fellow citizens.
What's your reaction to that, you know, the worries about the universities being the enemy?
So I have watched this evolve from my time in uniform leading the U.S. Naval Academy. I saw this start to creep into the American concerns and dialogue, trust in large institutions. Even during the pandemic, you started to see this come into the American consciousness. You know, the Gallup poll from last year that said only 36% of Americans had high confidence in higher education. And what Ron Daniels is talking about there is this this level of distrust that started to come into higher education. And we've got to accept that whether it's perception or real, that we've got to be able to answer to that. I mean, this is a university president. He's been the president of Johns Hopkins, the top research university in the country for 45 years. He's been there since 2009. We should be listening to him. He's been in this, you know, leadership role a long time. And we have to be willing to look ourselves as, you know, higher education institutions, say, are we exactly right? Do we have this right? Are we willing to make changes so that we are no longer looked at as the enemy, but we are a force for good? And when I say force for good, this is where we're going to be going at an institution like The Ohio State University. When I say force for good, I'm talking about attracting students because they want that experiential learning opportunity. They want to have the opportunity to get a degree. They want an opportunity to go and be a useful citizen, which means they're going to be part of the workforce, but also to serve in many ways, whether it be run for office, be part of a community project, whether it be just, you know, bringing up a family. This doesn't necessarily have to mean that you serve in uniform, of course, to do something that's bigger than yourself. And of course, our institutions are the economic driver for many of our states here. I mean, we're the largest employer in all of Central Ohio, number four in the entire state of Ohio. We're a $20 billion economic shot in the arm for the state of Ohio, and we're across the whole entire state. So we are, as an institution, not just the state's flagship. How Ohio State goes, so goes the entire state of Ohio. And I want people to be proud of their institution.
Now, on that event on Tuesday, one student interrupted the program, and you allowed him to speak for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And then he asked what they were asking you. I think there was two students talking, but one doing most of the talking. They asked you to come outside and meet with a group of students. The students were outside protesting, you know, a number of things, but mostly some of the actions regarding Senate Bill 1. Did you go outside and talk to the students afterward?
No, I mean, I have a really busy schedule and I had things to do. Now, here's the truth. I have met with that group of students within the first 2 weeks on the job. And I continue to meet with students and have open dialogue. I try to make myself accessible to listen to concerns. But I also want to make sure there's a time and a place for everything. And that's a little bit of this listen, learn, discuss module. You know, we don't have to agree on everything. And, you know, demanding something isn't always how you're going to get things to go your way.
So, I mean, I don't know how public you are on the university. I've been with Ohio State for quite some time. I can remember that on a nice sunny day, you couldn't turn the corner on the Oval without running into Gordon Gee by accident. Are you walking around or is your schedule just very busy?
I have done that a number of times. I love walking the Oval and I love just seeing the student groups that are out there, some of the guided tours that our students are leading for prospective future students. So, yes, I am out there a lot, and people do now recognize me. In fact, I can't go anywhere in the state of Ohio now without being recognized.
So if a group of students who are upset about some of the things in Senate Bill 1, maybe they went down to the state house, all of that, if they came up to you on the Oval, would you be happy to talk to them?
I would, and I have done that. I was, believe it or not, in Washington, D.C. last summer giving a talk at the National Press Club. And believe it or not, one of our students who had actually been arrested in one of those protests was there, and we had a straight up dialogue in front of a lot of people, and it was polite and respectful. And you know, I think that student has persevered through that and doing just fine.
So I wanted to talk about the Federal Department of Education just a little bit more. We mentioned it as relationship to the lawsuits, but the move to end the Department of Education does impact universities around the country. About 70% of the department's work involves student loans. There's a lot that's unknown right now, but what's your take on dismantling this department and your worries about things like FAFSA and the Pell Grants?
Yeah, I am concerned, as all of us in higher education administration are and should be. I mean, 80% of our students receive some sort of federal loan money, which is a lot. And we want to make sure that we continue that. You know, we've got to be prepared to handle whatever's coming out to us. As a lot of your listeners may know, it would require a vote by Congress to sunset the Department of Education. However, that doesn't mean that some of the functions can't start being parsed out, and that will probably be contested. But when it comes to the free application for federal student aid, when it comes to the student loan program, when it comes to accreditation, which is not done directly by the Department of Education, but it is done by another entity that nests within that, all those are really important functions that have to be done. Whether it's going to be done through the Small Business Administration, through Treasury, through Justice, for example, the Office of Civil Rights is part of the Department of Education. These are protection mechanisms that we need to have. Now, the intent here is to move a lot of these elements to the state. And, you know, the state of Ohio, we don't have a system here. You could argue that Ohio State is the closest thing to a system that exists out of the, you know, 24 community colleges, 23 regional campuses, 14 publics, 50 privates. We are a big, big higher education enterprise here in the state. So there could be some discussion about what the shift here in the state will look like at some point in the future when and if a Department of Education really does go away.
You think the state of Ohio will ask Ohio State to take over like loan programs or FAFSA or something?
No, I don't think so. But I do think we're going to have to be very involved in the conversation just because of our size, scale, and scope. And I'm happy to engage with Lieutenant Governor, with the state chancellor, and many others. And I know that, you know, that dialogue is going to start happening.
Do you agree with the overall just the framework of changing the Federal Department of Education, or do you think that maybe it's going a little too far?
You know, I've been involved at every level of the federal government, mostly in the Department of Defense for most of my career. I know there's a lot of bloat out there, and I don't think there's an American that votes that wouldn't want to see us be more efficient with our federal dollars. That said, the services that Americans get through the federal government are crucial to our livelihood and how we do things. So I'm not a fan of the chainsaw approach or just start cutting everything and see what really hurts. I wish this was being done with a little more accuracy. So, you know, these are the challenges of our time. I mean, this is who the public voted in, and this is their approach right now. And we have to be prepared to anticipate where we can and be ready to handle what's coming around the corner. And I will just say that we are being very thoughtful in how we do things. And, you know, we will protect and promote the mission set of what Ohio State does. And that's how we're going to be looking at this going forward.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking with Ohio State University President Ted Carter this hour. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about research funding. We're going to talk about academics. We're going to talk about a commencement speaker. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're spending this hour talking with Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Thanks again for being here.
Absolutely. Good to be here with you, Amy.
Ohio State recently announced that it set a record on research funding, a whopping $1.58 billion. That's more than Harvard, and that figure is up 9% from last year. Can you give us a sense of the type of research Ohio State is engaging in with all this money?
Well, first of all, I'm just very proud of what we've been able to accomplish in the research space. You know, we have over 14,000 faculty and students that are involved in the research arm at our university. As you point out, we're now approaching top 10 in the country. But it's more than the numbers. It's more than the ranking. It's what is it actually doing for Ohioans? And people should know that we are coming through with breakthroughs in cancer research, in heart disease, in programs that deal with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, diabetes. You know, the State of Ohio Adversity and Resilience study that we're doing is part of those research dollars, and those are state-supported. That project, looking at mental health and mental health trends just within the state of Ohio, is the only one of its kind in the entire country. So this is equivalent to the Framingham report that was done in Massachusetts in the 1950s that really changed how we approach heart disease. It was a game changer. And there's still so much we don't know about mental health and suicide and suicide-related behaviors. This is a project that's going to get after that. So there's so much that we're doing. And then not to mention in the agricultural world, which the state of Ohio is an ag state, 1 in 8 people here in the state of Ohio work in agriculture. We're in all 88 counties helping with soil health, pesticides, trying to get the most crop for every drop, so to speak. So we are deeply involved in the work that we do in our research, but it has big impact for the people of Ohio.
Now, there was news that one professor had $700,000 of research funding canceled by DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency.
Right.
That research was related to cannabis use, specifically with LGBTQ women. Does her research just stop, or can Ohio State help her out with the money that was supposed to be federal?
So unlike many other institutions that you're hearing about, to include our friends at Johns Hopkins, where they just laid off 2,200 researchers, we haven't laid off a single researcher. So I remember 14,000 researchers. So we're trying to make sure that all of our researchers continue to be funded at, you know, where we've had some small amount, and I want to emphasize they're relatively small in the big picture. I know when we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, it's still a number. We have been one of the least impacted thus far by any cuts in research dollars coming either through DOGE or through the federal government. The reality is National Institute of Health, National Science Foundation, the opportunities for their monies, which, you know, have in the historically past have been near trillions of dollars, are being reduced. Mm. So there won't be as many dollars to go get. Now, when we talked about $1.58 billion in revenue spend, $775 million of that came from the federal government. So we want to be clear-eyed about which money's coming from where. The rest of that money, to fill out that equation, comes from private industry and some from the state. And we have very strong, diversified research portfolio. Your listeners may have also heard that, the indirect cost rates for some of the federally funded research, which at many institutions would have an indirect cost rate of somewhere north of 50 to 60%. We are average rate around 40%, and they're putting a cap on that at 15%. So other institutions, 15%.
Oh.
So that's a very low rate compared to what had been normal. And we're going having to go back with a coalition of other like-minded research institutions and make sure that we educate not only our federally funded partners at NIH, NSF, but the federal government to make sure they understand that indirect things that cost are not overhead. Mm. These are the costs that are associated with the facilities, the laboratories, the energy required to run them, and oftentimes the PhD students who are put in there to do a lot of the work. Also, unlike a lot of our other higher education institutions, public and private, they've shut the spigot off to PhD students. Because of this reduction in some of the federal dollars coming to them. We have not done that also. So we're not looking like a lot of other institutions. I'm not saying we're going to go up another 9% in research dollars in the next year. It might be a lower number.
Well, it sounds like everyone's number will be lower.
It does, but we're going to still be very strong there. And I'll also point out that, you know, the city of Columbus, state of Ohio, we have fantastic industry partners here. So when you think about the new drone company here, Anduril, coming, we're already creating a partnership with them. We've had a relationship with Honda for, you know, well over 20 years. Amgen, a pharmaceutical company. A lot of these companies we work closely with, and even Intel, who's not here yet, we're still building a pipeline for students to go work there and are prepared to do research with them as well. So the point is our portfolio, because of the strength of who we are, is so diversified, we're going to remain strong there. We've had less than $4 million of cuts to our research grants done since they've made, you know, you've heard hundreds of millions of dollars at some of these other institutions, been relatively low impact to us, and we've been able to absorb that.
Now, earlier when we were talking about the Chase Center and we were talking about civics and democracy, I moved on before you had a chance. You told me before we came on the air that you have a strategy going forward. You want to be able to move past what's happening with Senate Bill 1. And can you talk to me about this? Because Senate Bill 1 looks like it's going to pass. Governor's going to sign it. So what's next?
Well, obviously, we'll deal with the effects and do all the analysis to be ready to enact the pieces that are in Senate Bill 1. That's first and foremost. We'll react to the things that are coming out of the federal government and make sure that we understand the impacts and the costs there. But since the day I got here, I went into a listening and learning mode to make sure I understood this incredibly complex campus, the Ohio State University, so that we could think through what do we want to be, where do we want to go over the next 5-10 years, And we created, at my investiture on November 8th of last year, we announced this plan called Education for Citizenship, which is our motto from 1938. And it's a really simple idea. We want to be the institution going forward that the United States, the state of Ohio, will not only be proud of, that's going to get it right, that's going to make these advancements in higher education, be the top of academic excellence, that does meaningful research, that takes clinical care to the next level. We are going to be investing in ourselves. Our enrollment numbers will maintain about where we are. We're going to continue to attract the best students here in the state of Ohio and across the country and around the world. So we're going to be and remain financially stable and strong. But to do that and to move up to those, you know, not just for the sake of higher rankings, but for the sake of actually producing the future citizens of this country, students who believe in something bigger than themselves, become great contributors to society and to our economy, and want to live, learn, and continue to learn here in the state of Ohio and a place like Ohio State. We want to be that institution that's first choice for a lot of people to come to and be part of.
In his State of the State address, Governor DeWine talked about higher education, and he referenced this initiative.
One of the biggest complaints that Fran and I have heard over many years from Ohioans, including legislators, is that it's too hard for Ohio students to get into some Ohio campuses. We're going to change that in our budget by guaranteeing admission to the main campus of every state college or university for all Ohio high school students who are in the top 5% of their class. They will be guaranteed admission into those schools.
So Ohio State is arguably harder to get into than it was, than it has in past years. Governor DeWine's budget hasn't passed yet, but what are your thoughts on this promise, this admission promise?
I'm fine with it. In fact, the governor and I have actually had this conversation. We talk quite often, and one of the first things he ever said to me is, why is it so hard to get into Ohio State? And I said, I want to remind people that Ohio State is for all Ohioans. If you want to come to Ohio State, if you have a dream of coming to Ohio State, there's a way to do it. And I remind people that, you know, we do have four regional campuses plus our, you know, community college Ag Tech Institute out in Worcester. Those are open enrollment. Anybody can go to Newark, to Lima, Marion, or Mansfield, and after 1 year, transfer with all their credits and be accepted to the Columbus campus at the Ohio State. And we're going to be creating better pathways for people to not only understand that, but to be incentivized to go to some of those campuses, as well as create better pathways for students to transfer from Columbus State Community College, a fantastic program right here where we already have 80 programs that students can transfer, again, with all their credits, especially if they have an associate's degree. And I do want to see the best students still want to come to Ohio State. So, you know, what's happening right now in higher education, there is this real thing happening called the enrollment cliff, and that's a lesser number of high school graduates because we didn't have the same population maintenance from 2007 to 2009 because of the recession. So there are about 5% fewer high school graduates coming out nationwide. Mm. So again, if more students want to come to Ohio State, I worry a little bit about, does that mean we're going to see fewer students want to go to Kent State or Toledo or Bowling Green? We'll see how that plays out. But I do want to incentivize students. We're going to look at some other programs to attract some of the best students in the state of Ohio, and I welcome them. I want to see students come in. And I have gone to the State House to brief with our General Assembly members because a lot of them didn't realize that 73% of our 67,000 students are from the state of Ohio.
73%? Okay.
Yeah, and that's part of being a land grant. I mean, mm-hmm. we're supposed to support the state of Ohio. By the way, that's not true at schools like Purdue and mm-hmm. Michigan, where 52% of their students are from the out-of-state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. Purdue, same thing, more than 50% out-of-state, and they're state-funded. So we're proud of that. And then one last point here, and the governor and I have talked about this, and we're going to continue to track this more closely, and this is part of my push to do more meaningful internships for our students. We want our best students, when they graduate here, to stay in the state of Ohio. And today, about 70% of our graduates, when they finish, decide to stay in the state of Ohio. And over 90% of them have a job already when they graduate.
We are down to literally the last minute. I want to give you a chance. You have picked a new commencement speaker, a very different speaker than last year's speaker, the cryptocurrency enthusiast Chris Pan. Who have you picked?
retired Major General, United States Marine Corps, Charlie Bolden, the former director of NASA, Naval Academy graduate. We know each other well. An inspirational gentleman. I think our commencement event's going to be a wonderful event. I can't wait to hear him speak.
And the Ohio State football team will be headed to the White House on April 14th. Are you going to go with them?
I will. I mean, I'm the president of the university. I think it's my role to be there. I've had the privilege of going to the White House for the Commander-in-Chief Trophy winners of Naval Academy on multiple occasions under President Obama. And I've been there with President Trump. So, you know, this is about respecting the office. And when you get invited to the White House, I think you should go.
All right. Well, that was Ohio State University President Ted Carter. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
And this has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.